The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. A friend of mine who teaches meditation on the East Coast in a little bit different tradition than this one was telling me that the first time that he taught, he was kind of excited about it, and he really enjoyed it. He felt like he was connecting with the students and was offering something that was valuable to them. But then one of the students asked a question. Asked, you know, this mindfulness stuff seems like a good idea, being present for the present moment, but what does it have to do with enlightenment? Like, what's the connection? Like, how do you get from the present moment to being an awakened being? And my friend felt like he scrambled, and he said, oh, well, in the present moment, that is where you find ease, and that's where you find peace and well-being, and that's where enlightenment happens also, in the present moment. And then the student came back with a retort, but yeah, but isn't that where cruelty happens too? That's also in the present moment. So are we cultivating other things besides just the propensity for awakening if we're in the present moment? My friend, he didn't tell me exactly how he responded to this, but he felt like he didn't have a really good answer to this and kind of like maybe fumbled his way through. And he and I were talking about this, like this connection between mindfulness or meditation and awakening. Right, in this Buddhist practice, we talk about mindfulness as part of the path, but how is it part of the path? There's a number of answers to that question, and so I'm going to look at it from one perspective and provide maybe some things that we can consider and look at. It's not the only way, but here's one way. And that is that we could say that mindfulness, or even meditation in general, has a role with awakening if it's done in the context of right view. And what is right view? Many of you may know that it's the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path. This keyword kind of path there. That is, if you want to follow a path that leads to a particular destination, it's helpful if you can see the path, if you know where it is, and you can find your way to it. So in that way, right view is a perspective that helps us find the path, and it allows us to see the starting point, the milestones, the destination on this path. And meditation in particular contributes to right view because meditation can help if we have some moments of ease, some moments of clarity, some moments of real contentment, well-being, that can give us a taste of the destination. Those can also be milestones like, oh, I can see that I'm having some movement on this path because I didn't used to notice these moments of clarity or ease. Or maybe even those moments of clarity and ease are happening more frequently because we're meditating. Also, as we meditate, we start to become a little bit more sensitive to those things that lead more towards awakening and those that lead more towards suffering. And that's a big part of what right view is. So, as many of you know, we use this expression, right view, but it's not right, quote unquote, as a way that's moralistically correct, or it's not dogmatically right. It's right in the sense that just as if you want to put a nail into a piece of wood, it's helpful if you get the right tool, a hammer. That's better than an egg beater, for example, right? Just the correct tool, the tool that's easiest to get it done. So that's the way we use the word right. And then view has two meanings, right? It's a noun and a verb. So a view is something we see. We go to vista points to see the view, see something beautiful that we maybe couldn't see otherwise if we didn't go to the vista point. And it's also a view, right? It's my own view. It's the way that I think. It's an opinion. It's a perspective. It's, yeah, so I'll leave that kind of a perspective. So right view is a way of a perspective in which that we can examine our life, experience our life, that helps us, leads towards awakening, helps us on this path that's the Buddhist path towards awakening. So more specifically, right view is a perspective that things arise from a cause and effect. Right, that, you know, if something has occurred, it's not completely random. It's not spontaneously generated. It is occurred because something else laid the foundation for it to occur. This isn't rocket science. We all know this, right, that cause and effect, that things are connected, that if something happens, there's a reason why it happened. But what makes this perspective of right view part of the Buddhist path is the very, very thorough application of this idea of cause and effect. That is, recognizing that taking paper clips from the office probably doesn't have a whole lot of immediate effects that we may see, but there's probably something. Just to recognize that there is an effect, whether we are immediately are aware of it, or whether it's immediately evident, or whether we consider it or not, there are effects. And I'll talk about this a little bit more in a moment. But just this idea that our actions, whether they're actions that we physically do in the world, or the actions or things that we say, or the actions or thoughts that we have, that they have consequences. The things that we do matter. The things that we do have an effect in the world. It does matter. Everything has an effect. Everything has a consequence. There aren't things without consequence. It just doesn't exist. What does exist is the magnitude of the consequence, right, is different, or whether it's readily apparent to us. But somehow, if we have this idea that everything matters, then we start to take a little bit more care, start to pay a little bit more attention to our actions, a little bit more attention to when we're experiencing something, to inquire, how did this happen? How did I get here? How is it that this event, this experience is occurring right now? So we shouldn't underestimate how much power this kind of perspective of that everything has a cause, that all causes have an effect, or every effect arose from an earlier cause. And our spiritual life, the Buddhist life, requires that we appreciate those actions that bring us suffering and those that bring us more freedom. And that's part of right view, is recognizing this, that there are, you know, different types of outcomes for different types of actions. But not only that, that our actions matter. They have consequences. And so this can help us have confidence that there is something that we can do that can help us alleviate our suffering. There is something we can do that help us experience more ease and happiness. And we need to have this type of confidence in order to practice. And I imagine that all of you have that to some degree. Otherwise, if you felt like, oh, just suffering is the way that it is and there's absolutely nothing that could be done about it, you wouldn't come to a Buddhist center, you wouldn't come to learn to meditate, you wouldn't meditate if you felt like nothing really mattered and wasn't going to make a difference. So this is part of right view, is, I keep on saying this, right, but that actions have consequences and that our actions matter, that what we do have effects. But the second part of right view is applying this perspective, this idea, in a particular way, and that is to this specific problem that the Buddha talked about, and that is suffering. And what I mean here by suffering is this either really obvious troubled mind that often, it's not so uncommon, right, to have moments of lots of stress and confusion, or confusion, as well as really subtle sense of, wow, everything's great, but it doesn't feel quite right. I wish there were more, right? Even that's a little kind of a subtle type of suffering too. So suffering is this, probably if you've been coming here to IMC or if you've been hearing other Dharma talks, you've heard this, that there's lots of different ways we can translate this word dukkha. I like suffering because that's how I heard it first and that stays in my mind. Some other translators will use words like stress, unsatisfactoriness. I kind of like Lee Brasington. He says bummer for things are a bummer. I kind of like, you know, that sense of being disappointed in things, the way things are. They're not quite satisfying enough. So when we apply this perspective to our suffering, it means that we take our suffering seriously. We're not dismissive of it. We're not trying to pretend that it's not there. We're not thinking that it's there for no reason at all. Instead, we're looking at it. We're taking a second look at our suffering. We're taking a third look at our suffering. And we're not doing this so that we can suffer better and really know all the different levels of suffering, but just so that we can understand it and so that we can really get to know it in a way that helps us work with it. Anything you want to work with, the better, the more you understand it, the better, the easier it is to work with. This is true of anything, right? If you want to fix the ice maker in your freezer, it's easier if you spend some time examining and figuring it out. I'm drawing from my own experience. But you just have to, you know, spend a little time getting to know it before you can choose which tools to use and figure out what to do with it. But also, just this movement of paying attention to suffering can help alleviate some of the suffering too. Because the pushing away of the suffering or the ignoring of the suffering can exacerbate it. And so stopping to do that can help alleviate some of it. Maybe it makes it go away, maybe it doesn't, but usually, right, to understanding something better can really help us find a new way with it. And so this right view requires that we kind of take an honest, upright, direct way of looking at our suffering, as opposed to succumbing to despair or hopelessness or blame or self-pity. Just looking at it and trying to put those other judgments about it to the side. Instead, we can honestly ask ourselves, how did I get here? What happened that I find myself here with all this suffering, with all this stress, with this sadness, with this anger, whatever it may be? What led me here? What kind of actions did I do, body, speech, or mind, that made it so that I find myself here now? And then if we do look at our suffering, often we will find, is kind of what the Buddhist teachings tell us, and often is our direct experience as well, that there is something underlying it, fueling it, feeding it, nourishing it so that it stays and persists. And what is underlying it is often this a contraction, an attachment, a clinging, a grasping, something that is the opposite of allowing things to be as they are. I'm doing this with my hands because this, for me, is kind of how I experience it. It's kind of like my shoulders go up towards my ears and I'm like making a fist when I am either trying to avoid something or I'm holding on really, really tightly to something, even though we all know that nothing is permanent. Everything changes. And when we're trying to really hold on to something and make it permanent, even though it's impossible, that leads to suffering. So many of you will know that this, of course, is the second noble truth. But clinging, contraction, attachment, tightness leads to suffering. And that's part of the right view as well, as the Four Noble Truths. And then the idea is, if we examine our suffering and we can see the clinging underlying it, then maybe we can soften. Maybe we can let go. Maybe we can relax a little bit that which is causing our suffering. With the idea that when the cause of suffering ceases, ends, then the suffering will cease and end. Again, this isn't rocket science. This is all, it's very clear. But kind of what makes this right view and part of the Buddhist practice is looking at suffering in particular and looking at our role. What is it that is not allowing things to flow, to arise and pass away as they naturally are? So there, in this way, right view is a perspective that we can use, and it uses a way to pay attention to our suffering. And it's something that we already do. It's not new. Maybe it's just applying something we already do in a particular way. The third noble truth is that is the cessation of suffering. And maybe we have glimpses of that during our meditation practice, as I mentioned earlier. But meditation also supports right view, which supports liberation, which also supports meditation, which supports liberation, which supports right view. They're kind of all intertangled here. That meditation can help us see more clearly, help us understand suffering. Just as the mind quiets down, we can see things that we couldn't see otherwise. I like this analogy. It's been very helpful for me to imagine that if there's a body of water, a pond, and there's a storm and it's windy, then maybe there's like waves in the pond and maybe even white caps, right, if it's big enough and windy enough. And if you throw a pebble into that pond, you know, it may not have much of an effect, or even any noticeable effect, because there's all these waves and all these other things happening. And maybe that's our daily life. Our mind is filled with all kinds of things, and we're buffeted by the winds of life. But as we meditate and as things start to settle down, as the waves start to settle down, as there starts to be a little bit more calmness, if that same pebble gets thrown in, then we can see there's a kaplunk, a splash, and ripples. So what we couldn't notice as suffering before, or maybe we couldn't notice as a type of clinging, because clinging is a type of suffering as well. What wasn't noticeable in the storms of our life becomes noticeable when we're meditating. And maybe that's this. And the third noble truth about the cessation of suffering is maybe we can start to see, have glimpses of that while we're meditating. And while we're meditating, we can start to see those things that contribute to not the cessation of suffering. And then, of course, the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, and which right view is the first factor. So what I just said is kind of a conventional view of the right view and part of the path. But my experience is a little bit different. I think this, I may not be alone in this, but I've had this idea that, okay, there's some clinging that it leads to suffering, and then maybe I can see that clinging either through meditation or through my regular life. But it's a particular type of hell to see yourself do those things that you know are going to cause suffering, but you still do them, right? There's this like, oh, I can for whatever reason, you may now have the awareness that this isn't helpful, but you keep on doing it. So in this way, I found kind of like this idea of cause and effect, when you see what leads to suffering, just soften and loosen it, not so helpful. I mean, it's a great idea. I like it. It makes sense on paper. It's perfectly logical. But when it came to my life, I found, oh, this wasn't so easy. In fact, sometimes it was really, really difficult and felt impossible. So now I have this different idea about right view. This way that for me it's been helpful, enormously helpful, and I offer it here with the idea that maybe it can be helpful for you guys as well. And that is, the way that I've been talking about this is we look at cause and effect, and we look at this one particular effect, suffering, and we look to see what is causing it, what came before it. Well, instead, what if we kind of turned it around? Instead of looking at the effect, we kind of looked at causes. And instead of looking at causes in particular, because another experience I've had, and perhaps you have had too, is I've had this idea, well, as soon as this one thing happens, then it's going to have this effect and everything's going to be fine. As soon as my neighbor's dog stops barking, then I'll be able to meditate, and then I'll find some ease, and I'll get some, you know, more ease in my life or some other experience. Or as soon as I get a better job, or as soon as, you know, there's all these things that we can do, right? But there has been times when the neighbor's dog did stop barking, but it didn't have the effect I was thinking, right? I still couldn't settle down in my meditation. I still couldn't find any ease. So this is a kind of another difficulty with this idea of cause and effect. It's what we think is a cause that's going to have a particular effect doesn't always have that effect. Or maybe sometimes it does. Maybe that during meditation we notice that there's a pain in the knee. And then we can notice in the mind there's a lot of aversion to the pain in the knee. And then for some reason we're able to lessen the aversion and just kind of relax into it. And then we notice that the knee pain diminished. It's like, oh, great. So if I can relax my aversion, then the pain diminishes. But the next time there's pain, I relax the aversion, that doesn't happen. And maybe there's a temporal relationship, that is, that the lessening of pain occurred after the lessening of aversion, but maybe there's something else happening. Maybe we were able to lessen the aversion because we got lost in some lusty fantasy or idea, and that just distracted us for a moment from the pain. It wasn't because we were able really to lessen our suffering. So here's an alternative, a different way to think about it, is about creating the conditions for something to arise. Instead of saying, I want to have a particular effect and I'm going to do this thing which I think is going to cause that, instead of experiencing something and looking back and trying to figure out why it is, we can set an aspiration. We can set something that, a direction we want to go, and create conditions that increase the likelihood that this aspiration will occur. That's all we're doing, is putting in place things, activities, objects, words that we say, things that we do, that increase the likelihood that something's going to happen. And this can be beneficial. This kind of different way of looking at things can be beneficial in a number of ways. One, I already said that we often don't know the exact cause and effect relationship. Even though we may think that we do, it doesn't work out exactly. And this cause and effect idea, in the Buddhist teachings, they use this word karma. And also in the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha is reported to have said, Don't try to figure out karma. You'll lose your mind if you try to figure this out, right? It's too complicated because there's so many different factors getting together. So that kind of, for me, is not encouraging as a way to try to tease apart exactly like what's happening that's caused this to arise. But it's also another thing that is said about karma is that all of our actions of body, speech, and mind plant a seed that have the potential to give fruit. Now this, I like this idea, this potential to give fruit. Doesn't mean that it's immediately going to blossom and turn into fruit. But what it does mean that if the right conditions are in place, then a seedling can grow and fruit can arise. That is, if there's soil, if there's water, if there's sunshine, those types of things will give rise to fruit. So then we can ask ourselves, well, what kind of conditions are we creating that allows what kind of seeds to blossom? Are we giving sunshine, soil, water that will allow the positive fruits of actions we've done in the past to arise? Or are we making it easier for those particular fruits that may be rooted in greed or hatred or delusion? Are we making it more likely that something that's has a positive effect for our lives and in the world is going to arise? Are we making it more likely that something that is coming out of greed or that is harmful to ourselves or harmful to others to arise? And so what are these conditions? What are this, the soil, the water, and the sunshine? And the way that I'm thinking about that is those are the qualities that are in our minds. These are our habits, our proclivities, our tendencies, the things that we're doing that without really thinking, when we're kind of on autopilot or that by default that we do. These are part of the conditions that create that increase the likelihood for one or another type of action to bear fruit. And so our neuroscientist friends talk about neural networks. So I think of conditions as which neural networks are we turning into superhighways? Which ones is it easier to for our thoughts to follow, to have, you know, easy entrance ramps, and you can go really fast along those. And so there's two ways that we can create conditions, that we can create these neural networks. There's two different times in which these conditions get created. One, when we're meditating. Two, when we're not meditating. Right? Everything we do, kind of part of the right view, is that everything we do matters. Everything we do has a consequence. Everything we do creates a condition. And so if we have the habit, the proclivity, the tendency to blame others, then if we are fueling, sorry, I just lost my train of thought there. So no matter what we are doing, whether we are meditating or not, right, we are fueling these tendencies in our minds. But one real advantage also to looking at conditions, about this idea that we want to create the conditions for something to happen as opposed to make something happen, is this: there can be tremendous freedom in this idea that we don't have to be the agent that makes something happen. Instead, we are the agent that creates conditions in which something else can arise. It's not up to us to make everything arise. We increase the likelihood that it's going to arise by creating conditions. And one way I think about this is with meditation. if, right, that practice that we do here often is that we choose an anchor, the breath, when the mind wanders off. And when we wake up, we just bring our mind back to the breath. That's kind of, you know, classic mindfulness. How does this happen, that moment when we wake up? Who is doing that? How is that happening? We're not doing it in the sense that, right, if we could do that, our mind wouldn't have drifted away in the first place, right? So if we have this intention, we always want to be awake, then we wouldn't have drifted away. Instead, it just happens. And those of you who have a regular meditation practice know that it happens more frequently. It happens maybe with a longer duration the more you meditate. So you're creating the conditions in which for that to arise again and again. But you yourself aren't actually making it happen. And I also have this experience kind of in the negative way of sitting a retreat and being really, really restless, really restless. I was just all I could do to stay on my zafu. I didn't know why, what was happening, but I was having a terrible time sitting there. And I had the really good fortune of having two people sit on either side of me who were so still. And I really wanted to be kind to them because I felt like they had been kind to me. They had been so still. And I was saying to myself, this. I had this little mantra going, don't move, don't move, don't move, don't move, don't move. And then what did I do? I moved. I shifted. It was amazing, right? I had this real intention. I'm not going to do this. This little mantra going. But still it happened. Like even though my intention was different, so it wasn't me. I don't know exactly how it happened, right? I wasn't aware. I didn't plan to do it. I didn't make the choice to do it. It just happened. And in fact, neuroscientists will point this out too. There's a lot of fascinating research in this area, and some of it they have shown with neuroimaging that the intention to do an action arises before we have conscious awareness of that intention. And then we actually may move. So then that leaves, something that philosophers have said before is that, you know, we make our decisions, we do our choices based on, I don't know, preferences, proclivities, habits. We make our decisions based on that. And then afterwards, we add some logic to it. And afterwards, we add reasoning to it. But the initial decision was made just kind of maybe more of an intuitive or maybe not as volitionally as we would like to think. I don't know if this is true. But it does point to that the power of, again, kind of our habits of our mind. And so if we have this idea that we want to create the conditions, the habits for good things to arise, for happiness to arise, for ease to arise, then we can practice in that manner. So in this way, meditation, where we have moments of ease, where we have, hopefully, not always, right? Sometimes we have like meditations like I described of being incredibly restless and having a difficult time being settled. But meditation can help us create the conditions in our minds in which there are more and more times in which there's ease, in which there's peace, maybe even some happiness, some spaciousness. And the more times that happens in our mind, we're creating the conditions for that to be a habit for other things, for that to be a response at other times, and to increase the likelihood that it's going to happen again. So in this way, kind of like setting the conditions for things to arise is kind of like following a North Star. We choose something, a direction we want to go, and then make lots of small decisions that help us go in that direction. Not necessarily because we think exactly we're going to arrive at the North Star and grab the North Star and own it and have it, but we just set the direction, the way that we want to go. And in a way, this is right view too. It's a perspective of choosing the right, the direction towards freedom and a way towards suffering. A practical application of this is something that's rather mundane, but I had this intention I wanted to do more walking, to spend more time outside walking. So I found myself, I had to work myself up to this. So I found myself doing little things to set the condition, to kind of like lower the barriers to this. So first was like, I'm a little bit embarrassed to share this, but I just wanted to make sure that my favorite socks were clean, right? You know, just the ones that have the right amount of padding, but they're not too thick, and you know, this type of thing, right? And make sure that I knew where my water bottle was. Like, where is that? And, like, put it in a place that's really obvious so it's easier for me to kind of grab it if I want to go out. And I put some Dharma talks on my little iPod, you know, just in case I wanted to listen to something other than the birds. And I didn't run around the house all doing this all at once. It was more kind of this, oh, yeah, well, when I'm doing laundry, make sure I get the socks go in there. And maybe I'm going to make sure my water bottle stays here on the counter where I will see it. And so in these ways, I'm just doing small, mundane, simple things, but I'm helping create the conditions in which it's easier. I'm increasing the likelihood. I'm lowering the barriers of things that it's not going to happen and increasing the likelihood that it will happen. And this way, I'm creating the conditions for it to go, for me to go walking. And in fact, it worked. And many of us have this experience, right, that when you have a positive experience, it was pleasant, it was so nice to go outside. Then I came home and I'm like, oh, I wonder how far that I walked. Wow, I went down here and I found an app that I put on my phone to then measure how far I go, right? And that gets me excited about going just because I like these silly things. But, right, it's just we have to begin with setting the intention and creating the conditions. I think if I had said, Diana, go out walking every day. You must do this. It wouldn't have worked so well. Diana, meditate longer every day. That wouldn't have worked so well. But putting candles near where I meditate, I actually like candles. That helps support me. That's something that helped create the condition. Test drove a number of different zafus. You know, this one I like better. That one's different. You know, these types of things. We can create the condition small, simple, mundane things. So in this way, it's kind of a way that we can look at right view. It's still the idea of cause and effect, and it's still the idea that our actions have consequences. But instead of focusing on suffering and the tightening that underlies the suffering, we can still do that. But another way to view it is to create the conditions that increase the likelihood that something that we're aspiring towards occurs. And maybe I'll stop there. Just with the... Maybe I'll end with saying that when I first sat down here, it made me very happy to see you all. And that kind of helped create the conditions for me to find a little bit more ease here so that I could share with you. And now I have the wish for the conditions to come together for you all to find some ease and some happiness and your highest aspirations. And may you all find some peace and well-being and freedom. Thank you.